Well, good evening. Good to be with you. When we think of Caleb, we think of canines. I know that's raised a few eyebrows. You are like a dog, so said Caleb's father to him by giving him the name Caleb, a dog. At least that's what most commentators seem to think it's what it means. So Caleb was a rough man? Maybe. Old and mangy? Perhaps. But despite its negative connotation in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and even today, a dog, at least in Hebrew, can also mean enduring, faithful to his master, or even all heart. Our NIV translation says about Caleb six times throughout Numbers and Joshua that he was wholehearted, something that we thought about this morning and will again tonight. Caleb was wholehearted towards God. Wholehearted. That's probably what being a dog meant. So Caleb was the unpolished oyster, but on the outside. But on the inside, he was a priceless pearl, a man who wholeheartedly devoted himself to God. We read Caleb's story in Numbers 13 and 14 also, after the Exodus, somewhere around 1400 BC, where only he and Joshua had the faith to believe that God would help Israel to take the promised land of Canaan. But we revisited that story in Caleb's own words 45 years later that Sarah just read for us from Joshua 14 and 15. And did you notice that word wholeheartedly coming up three times in Joshua 14? Wholeheartedly. So let's look this evening at what it means for us to be wholehearted towards the Lord as we dip into Caleb's story. The first thing that wholehearted means, the first thing that it indicates, is going against the flow, committing to follow God even when it means going against the flow. That was certainly Caleb's story. It's a well-known story, isn't it? Numbers 13. God tells Moses to send out some spies to explore Canaan, the land that God is giving Israel. And as you'll remember, all 12 spies were leaders in their tribes. But when they reported back, 10 of them became afraid because they saw powerful people there, large and fortified cities. And even the descendants of Anak, both Jewish legend and the text itself, thinks of the Anakites as the children of the Nephilim, the hybrid fallen angels, human giants of Genesis 6. Well, wouldn't you be afraid? Or would you be like Joshua and Caleb, whose attitude was, God will give us this land? It says, Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it. Later, Joshua and Caleb tear their clothes and they say to the entire Israelite assembly, the land is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land and he will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Caleb was going against the flow. That speech almost got him stoned by his own kinfolk. But having seen the land of Canaan, believing God's promises meant trusting him, even if the majority didn't. Without turning to Numbers 13, can anyone here remember the names of any of the 10 spies who came back afraid with a bad report? No? Well, good, because there's no reason why we should, because history has forgotten them. I won't even read them out now. But history has not forgotten Caleb, because Caleb is promised by God that he and Joshua alone would enter the promised land, but no one else from the Egyptian slavery generation. Why? Numbers 14:24 says, because Caleb had a different spirit in him and followed the Lord wholeheartedly. Perhaps Caleb was used to being the odd one out, the black sheep, even from his childhood, because I wonder if you noticed, Joshua 14:6 and Joshua 14:14 say that Caleb's father, Jephunneh, was a Kenizzite, not an Israelite. The Kenizzites were one of the tribes whose land God gave to Abraham's descendants in the covenant of Genesis 15. And while we don't know the circumstances of Caleb's birth, integrating into the Israelite community and culture as a family from the Kenizzite community would have made Caleb realize growing up, yes, that he was different. But that only drove him towards wholeheartedly committing to, the text names it, Israel's God, the Lord, becoming a leader as he did in the Messianic tribe of Judah, giving him not only a bold and generous and courageous and noble and heroic spirit, but he also had, more importantly, God's spirit. God's spirit, the spirit and the influence of the God of Israel. That is the God of heaven who raised him above all earthly fears. His spirit, God's spirit in him, was different to the spirit of others. And using New Testament language now, if you are a believer, God has already given you that spirit too. His spirit, you are favored, you are different. The writer and theologian James Sidlow Baxter said, "What God chooses, he cleanses. What God cleanses, he molds. What he molds, he fills. And what God fills, he uses." You too, if you are a believer, are different. So live different. Like Caleb, go against the flow. That's what God calls us to. It can be applied in Christian leadership. This is a dangerous thing to say in a congregational church, no. I guess your ears have pricked up now. But those who walk by sight alone will always be the majority. The Bible teaches us that over and over again. Vision is the ability to see above and beyond individual preferences. For whilst we all have a role and an influence at Cambrai, opinion polls alone must never be what leads the church. Then, as now, vision means discerning the mind of Christ, not going with the opinion of the 10 frightened spies and the community at large, ready to stone Caleb and Joshua. It's true in leadership. It's true as we live Christ-centered lives going against the flow of our culture. Have you ever tried to kayak upstream? It's hard, isn't it? Even dangerous. I remember almost capsizing doing just that in a kayak on a river in Luxembourg. Or have you ever been to a concert or a sports event and are going in the opposite direction to thousands of people walking the other way? I remember my curiosity nearly getting me trampled when walking in, when everyone else was walking out of Centre Court at Wimbledon after the ladies' final a few years ago. But that's a picture of the Christian life, isn't it? Going against the flow. A paraphrase of 1 Peter 4, 3 to 5. The majority doesn't like it when you stand up against their way. Our culture talks tolerance, but it's tough on Jesus followers. How is God calling you to be a Caleb this evening? Different to our culture. In what areas of your life does God say to you, go against the flow? Is it in how you spend your leisure time? Is it in what you read? Is it in how you spend your money? Is it, as we were hearing this morning, how you use your home? Is it the sort of relationship that you have with the opposite sex? How is God calling you as a Christ follower to be different? Just a short silence, just to consider that before we continue. Well, if wholehearted means going against the flow, it also means, in the life of Caleb, acting on God's promises. The thing that kept Caleb going for 45 years was that he never doubted the integrity of God and his word. He never doubted the integrity of God and his word. Did you notice that in Joshua 14? Look at verses 6 to 12 again. Let's remind ourselves. Joshua 14 from verse 6. Now the men of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal. And Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions. And my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people sink. I, however, followed the Lord, my God, wholeheartedly. So on that day, Moses swore to me, 'The land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord, my God, wholeheartedly.' Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. And I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourselves heard that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out, just as he said." Caleb, can you imagine, is 85 years old. I won't ask for a set of hands to show who's older than 85 years old here. But he's 85 years old and he's still keen to go into battle and claim what God had promised to him 45 years before. The facts seem to be going against Caleb, don't they? Can you see at least three reasons why you wouldn't want to fight if you were Caleb? Number one, he was 85 years old. Number two, this was the hill country, geographically, the hardest part of Canaan to capture. And number three, the Anakites are still there after 45 years, those Nephilim-descended giants, or so it was believed. By the way, people do PhDs on the Nephilim and their offspring and how that story is used to give a Jewish explanation for the origins of evil on earth. A good conversation starter, perhaps at a party. But Caleb doesn't consider age, hills, or giants a problem. And so Joshua 15:14, Caleb took Kiriath Arba, what would become Hebron, just 25 miles south of Jerusalem, and drove out the Anakites. Can you imagine this 85-year-old man clambering up the hill, ready to claim that which God had promised him, driving out the Anakites? I don't know whether it was through force, or maybe in my mind's eye, I imagine it as a Reverend Ian Paisley-style growl and stare. The point is, for Caleb, believing God's promises did not mean just sitting back and waiting for them to happen. It meant acting upon them. Acting upon them. His theology was simply minimize the adversary, magnify God, and not the other way round. And that led to action, to defeating the enemy as God had instructed. And so the man with the most difficult inheritance to claim was the one who claimed it totally. And in drawing some sort of parallel today, when we face adversaries and opposition to the gospel, it is not because God's promises have failed, nor that God is somehow anything less than sovereign. It's part and parcel of God's plan, a plan that requires us to act upon those promises, to take risks for the kingdom. The greatest risk, of course, is not taking any. But God is sovereign. God is in charge. And therefore we can get up and go out in confidence, acting upon his promises, doing what he's asked us to do as a church and as individual believers. In the 1700s and late 1700s, early 1800s, parts of the Protestant church, you may know, were locked in a debate about that which came to be called, long word alert, hyper-Calvinism. Crudely put, that which so emphasizes God's sovereign choice that it denies human responsibility to believe in Christ. Sometimes the term can be used pejoratively. You know, what's hyper-Calvinism? It's anyone with a theological position to the right of me, but that's true for everyone. But the question is, could the evidence of our lives be used to accuse us of effectively being hyper-Calvinists? Do we say, or have you ever thought, yes, I believe in God's plans, I believe in God's purposes, but that doesn't mean that I need to do anything. That doesn't mean that I need to act upon them. That doesn't mean that I have to actually go out and tackle that problem head on. That doesn't mean that I have to actually share the gospel with someone. I'm already safe. I'm already saved. That's true. If God wants to fulfill his promises, well, he'll do it himself. I'll leave him to it. But no, God could do it himself. Of course, he's able to do it himself. He's completely sovereign. But he chooses us and he saves us by grace alone, precisely so that we can participate in his purposes. Precisely so that we can act upon his promises and be part of his plans, not just a disinterested bystander. So like Caleb, we too must act upon God's promises, even though we know that it's rough terrain, if we're honest, and it requires everything. God promises that his gospel will be preached in all the earth. And who's going to do that? We are the ones that he chooses to act upon that promise and to share the gospel in all the earth. I love the story of John Peyton, the first missionary to the New Hebrides Islands in the South Pacific in 1858, islands inhabited supposedly by cannibals. Apparently, before he left Scotland, a Mr. Dixon wrote to him, urging him not to go. And he wrote back, and he said, "Mr. Dixon, you write and say that if I go, I will be eaten by cannibals. You are an aged man, Mr. Dixon. Soon you will die, and you will be eaten by worms. As long as I can follow the Lord, it makes no difference whether I am eaten by cannibals or by worms." So he got on the ship, and he sailed halfway around the world. And as he got to the islands, the captain of the ship tried to keep Peyton and his wife from getting off the boat. He said, "Sir, if you go to that island, you will die." And Peyton replied, "Sir, I died before I came." Sometimes we want the Christian life to be easy, don't we? For God to simply do his thing and not to involve us. But as one person put it, you can't follow a man with a cross on his back and expect an easy life. God doesn't promise us an easy life. But he does promise us the best life. In losing our life for his sake, we find it. When we look to nothing except God's honour, God will look in turn to our honour. Apparently, Queen Elizabeth I sent a certain merchant over to Holland, and he complained to her, and he said, "If I do your business, my own business will be ruined." And the Queen was supposed to have said, "You do your business, you do my business, and I will see to your business." And so it is with God. "You do my business," God says, "and I will see to your business." So can we see this 85-year-old man, Caleb, wholeheartedly finishing his life strong, going against the flow and acting on God's promises? He didn't look for retirement. He looked for reassignment. Caleb shows us that age has little to do with achievement for God's kingdom, but being wholehearted has everything to do with it. Caleb received the promises of God. Caleb blessed his family with a heritage of courageous faith. Caleb was a faithful inspiration to those who followed after. It's a sad truth that for many who call themselves believers, all they will leave behind is a will for their kids to fight over rather than an example to follow. But how good it is to leave behind an example of faith, of trusting in God, of being different and acting upon his promises. It is like the tree of Psalm 92. And with this, we finish. Are we, like the righteous, flourishing like a palm tree, growing like a cedar of Lebanon, planted in the house of the Lord, flourishing in the courts of our God? Are we, or will we, still bear fruit in old age, staying fresh and green, proclaiming, "The Lord is upright"? May we be like that as we wholeheartedly go against the flow and act upon God's promises.